Welcome to the Shakeout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Van Buskirk. More weeks than not, Maddie and I end up covering stories of doping infractions on the rundown, and we decided to take a deeper dive into this subject. Each episode, we'll choose an event and give you a rundown of the top 10 all-time performers, investigating each runner's history of doping or lack thereof. Our goal is to determine, at least on paper, which are the cleanest and dirtiest events in our sport. This is The Dirty Stuff. Well, welcome to the first edition of The Dirty Stuff of 2021. We are talking about the men's 5,000 meter, and we are once again, for the second time in the new year, joined by, actually the third time, Maddie, this new year. We've been so lucky, joined by a guest host, Mr. Ben Flanagan, standout at the University of Michigan, where amongst many of his other accolades, he was the NCAA 10,000 meter champion and has gone on to do some other incredible things in our sport, including just last month, debuting the half marathon in an incredibly speedy 103.19, putting him solidly on that top 10 fastest Canadian all-time list in that distance. Benny Flanagan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kate. I'm really happy to be here. Big fan of the podcast. So I appreciate you letting me come on here today.
We're thrilled to have you. So let us know where you're joining us from right now.
Yeah, so I'm currently in Charlottesville, Virginia. Most notably, the University of Virginia is based out of here, but it's our current training grounds. You know, I'm a member of the Reebok Boston Track Club, which gets its name from the Reebok headquarters in Boston. But yeah, we for most of the time of the year, we're here in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's a great area for training. I think it's probably close to 10, 12 degrees Celsius today. So the winters are quite moderate. Gives us opportunity to train outside all year. The hilly terrain, so it's a good place to train. So I'm just working away here, gearing up for any potential races down the road.
So I want to talk about those potential races coming up, but maybe you could first of all take us back to, what was it, December 9th, just over a month ago, to that half marathon debut, because that was a pretty stellar performance, Ben. Can you maybe walk us through that event and tell us how it felt?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the kind words related to it. That was a really fun opportunity for me. It was something that, for lack of a better term, kind of just came up. It was an opportunity that kind of fell on our laps. And my coach approached me and said, "Hey, I know this is kind of outside your typical range in terms of what you compete in, you know, being a 10,000 meter specialist. But I, given the lack of opportunities this past year, I thought it just fits so well with kind of the dynamic of our training as well. So this fall, I've really been focusing on strength work. I finished off last season with a 10,000 meter PB. So I was like, you know what? I'd love to take a swing at this and kind of see where the strength is at. So sure enough, as the time got closer, the expectations and goals kind of just got higher and higher. And I was honestly pretty intimidated, because when you do the math and you kind of break down, the average kilometer, average mile for 13 miles or 21K, you're just like, oh, wow, it's actually, you're moving pretty fast for a long time. So I went in pretty, I don't know, conservative, I would say. And I kind of just stuck with the pack for as long as possible. And then made a move probably at 9 miles and was really happy with my last 10K. I didn't wear my watch, and there was no timers on the course. So I had no idea the pace I was running or anything like that. So to find out that I actually made my way to the Canadian top 10 list was quite a pleasant surprise. And it's always, very great to get a win. So I won't be running anything like that in the near future, but whenever I do make that transition, I can't wait, because I really think there's some more potential there.
The no watch. No watch on the roads. It's, you're not the first person to tell us that they were grateful they didn't have a watch. Or even Andrea, we had Andrea on last week, and she was a little bit different in the sense that she just found herself in no man's land, so she had to go out hotter than she wanted to, but it totally paid off. And I feel like the no watch is the same principle of, like, sometimes you know what you can do in your brain better than, you know, what your Garmin tells you. So it's very cool.
Yeah, maybe tell us about that strategy. Like, that was obviously an intentional decision. So, you know, so many runners are so bound by the numbers and the precision of hitting off, you know, certain splits. So what went into that decision for you?
Yeah, 100%. And honestly, like, I think it benefits me because, you know, I'm an overthinker. You know, I read too far into the splits and, my pace. So, for me, I didn't wear a watch because I so badly want to know every detail all the time. So it's less of like, this is a liberating, I guess it ends up being liberating, but it's more of a feeling of like, okay, you're going to stare at this thing if you have it on. So just leave it behind and you don't have a choice. So yeah, I do like having clocks every once in a while to check in. You know, honestly, like the math gets difficult. And once you get over 5K, that most of the time you don't even know what pace you're running anyways. But yeah, I think it can be really beneficial to just listen to your body, especially when you're in a really good place fitness-wise and you're just confident. So I totally could see some athletes that need it and I guess really respond well to that feedback. But for me, I think it probably would cause, you know, more damage than good having the watch, that is. So I'm glad I didn't wear it and it seemed to work out in this case.
Were you surprised at all by your finish time, given all of that?
Yeah, I definitely was, because for the first half, things felt probably like too comfortable, like to the point that I was like, I don't think we're running crazy fast right now. So I didn't really, and we went that, we stayed at that pace for a pretty long time, like probably close to 10K. So at that point, when I started to make a move, I didn't really know how much room I really had to kind of like knock down the pace enough to end up with the time I was, you know, would be happy with. I told myself time doesn't matter, but you always kind of have those, you know, those goals in your mind. So I really thought that I was ready to run around 63 minutes. So to just, you know, completely go out there and I guess wing it in terms of pacing strategy and to come pretty close to that, I was pretty happy with. So I'd love to be in another event where maybe I go out a little more aggressive and kind of see how that strategy pays off. But for the first one out there, it definitely took an intimidating event and made it a lot more, manageable and gave me a lot more confidence for my next time.
So you're not a complete stranger to the roads. You've had some pretty awesome success in other events. And I'm thinking back to that Falmouth road race, which I believe is it's a 15K. Is that right?
It's 7 miles on the dot, which I think checks
out. Oh, it's 7 miles.
Yeah, no, it's totally fine. It ends up being pretty close to 15K. I think it's like maybe 11.2, I think it might come out to. But it's an odd race distance, just over 10K.
Well, and you were, I believe, the first Canadian to win that in decades, you know, and so that was, I guess, a few years ago now, but you've certainly not been a stranger to a large amount of success on the road. So I've got to ask, I'm sorry, but I've got to ask the obvious question. Is there a future of possibly tackling a marathon in there somewhere?
Totally. Yeah, that's a fair question. And I definitely have full intentions to, you know, really take a good, solid swing at the marathon and hope to really, you know, if all things go according to plan, I hope the marathon's the best event in my career. So I kind of always knew I would end up there at some point. And I don't know, I feel like a lot of my progress on the track has come so delayed, I guess. You know, I went through most of college and was really struggling to kind of hit the times that I wanted. So now in the past few years, kind of having a steady trajectory of progress, I want to move away from the track career as satisfied as possible, because I don't really want to just like dabble with the marathon. Like when I go into it, I want to run some major events. I would love to, you know, take a crack at getting as close or under that Canadian record at some point, which, you know, is probably not going to, it looks like it's going to keep getting faster and faster by the time I get up there. But I think I've always wanted to be there. And with the current status of Canadian marathon running, getting more competitive and more exciting, like, I guess I'm just getting more and more anxious to move up and be a part of that in the near future. So I don't know whether it'll happen, you know, next year or not, given the status of the Olympics and things like that. But, you know, hopefully not too far away. I'd like to get back to the roads and make that my primary event.
Also, they say it's harder and harder to get faster the older you get. So, you know, make hay while the sun's shining. I think your decision makes sense.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it is... you know, just the difficulty of it. Like, I think that'd be tough to balance kind of being an athlete in the middle. And I'm sure there's athletes that would be better at it than me. You know, I've had a couple injuries in my career, and I don't know, the combination of like trying to hold on to speed while increasing the mileage, I think would be pretty tough for me to balance. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, like, I feel like I love the track, but there's so many road races that aren't marathons, you know, that are 7 miles or road 5Ks or road 10Ks that I haven't been able to run because I'm focusing on track events. So even if I'm in a marathon buildup, I'd love to spend time, you know, at the shorter distances, but on the roads instead, as opposed to going to the track. And that would be kind of my fix, I guess.
Well, and from a practical standpoint, the roads are where the money is too. Like, it's not all about making a buck. We don't obviously run track and field to get rich, but that's kind of a little incentive, is that certainly the prize money is significantly better on the roads.
Yeah, 100%. You know, that's definitely a fun side of the sport to, I don't know, get into every once in a while, to compete for prize money and, you know, really try to see like if you can hit those bonuses. It's definitely a good incentive. So yeah, I mean, that's if I would say the roads is definitely where I've made the most money. So that's always an added bonus. But as you said, it's definitely not like an expectation or like why you do it. But I mean, it certainly, it doesn't hurt when you're looking to, you know, buy a home and, you know, have a family in the future. It doesn't matter. It doesn't hurt to have a few extra dollars in the bank.
Absolutely. Well, it'll be fun, Ben, for all of us, our listeners and our readers, everyone in the community, to continue following your path as you go along this this maybe transition to the roads, down the road, so to speak. But in the nearer future, of course, we've got this thing called the Olympics, hopefully coming up in a few months. And you've talked a lot about maybe wanting to even double that 5K, 10K. So let us know kind of how things are going with that, you know, that goal right now. You mentioned that you might have a couple races coming up in the next couple of months.
Yeah, 100%. So all the focus is totally on qualifying for the Olympics for Team Canada. You know, I try not to look too closely in terms of like what the Olympics is going to look like or whether it happens or whether it doesn't. Like I'm all in no matter what. I'm trying to, you know, just hit the benchmarks that I need to hit to be on the team, assuming everything goes according to plan. For me, the 5K and the 10K, the reason I bring that up is because the recent introduction of the ranking system and like these super standards, as opposed to the traditional qualifying method that's been consistent for so long, has really added this like strategic component in terms of qualifying for major championships. And what I mean by that is it's like the 10K, you know, I feel more confident in terms of my ability in Canada to, you know, being one of the top athletes in the nation in that event. But in terms of globally, there's actually fewer spots at the Olympics in that event. So you really have to be competitive internationally as well, which, you know, I have confidence in that as well. Whereas the 5K, you know, is my secondary event and, you know, it's a super, super hot distance in Canada right now. So it's going to be really competitive. But there's also more spots, you know, within the limits at the Olympics. So it's kind of just like a, I don't know if it's catch 22 is the right word, but for me, what makes the most sense is to pursue both, especially if I'm relying on qualifying off of ranking. And at the end of the day, kind of seeing which one I have the better opportunity on getting in on. And if I happen to hit the standard in either, then that's going to be the sole event I focus on.
And
does that all make sense?
Yeah, I was going to say, and just for a little context, that's because the 5K at the Olympics has heats and finals, whereas the 10K is a straight final. So that's where you get the discrepancy in participants.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, we'll see. I think everyone's kind of learning from the ranking system, considering this is the first Olympic cycle where they're implementing it. So yeah, I don't think we're really going to know until basically like June in terms of what times it takes to be in a certain spot to actually make it off of ranking. So that's going to be a constant, check in to just kind of see where I'm at. But there's also some ways the ranking overlaps, that if you run a fast 5K, it can benefit your 10K. So there's really no harm in pursuing both. And that's kind of the incentive behind it all. So
is that how I didn't know that with the 5K and 10K?
Yeah, it's only the 5 can benefit the 10. The 10 doesn't benefit the 5.
Okay.
So yeah, so as you can tell, I've thought about this quite a bit. But yeah, that's kind of my rationale for it. And, you know, I don't think I've totally figured out the 5K yet. So if I can, you know, get better at the 3K and even the mile and get a really good crack at the 5K with some strength in me, I think I could be hopefully as competitive as that in the 10, but we'll just have to see how the year plays out. But Kate, in terms of racing, yeah, the plans are to hopefully race an outdoor meet that's being set up in the South at the end of February, and then looking towards hopefully a fast 10K to be set up, because considering that event is seemingly more difficult and difficult to find across North America. So huge credit to kind of the grassroots organizations that have been putting on some events for athletes to actually have the ability to qualify for these events, because they've been putting so much work in to provide these opportunities.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we appreciate that shout out. I mean, we've seen that, you know, a few times in some bigger ways over the last few months, obviously the first one being the Marathon Project, which kind of seems, you know, funny a bit, I guess, to consider that a grassroots given the magnitude of the kind of event they put on. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was just a bunch of, you know, runners and coaches and agents that came together and said, hey, we need something, right? Like we gotta think outside the box and be a little more creative about how we give people opportunities to actually get these marks in. So that's awesome, Ben. We'll be so excited to follow along certainly over the next couple of months, and keep us posted on how this all goes. We'll be sharing your results with our readers and listeners for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the last thing, I don't know if I kind of snuck my way in there, so a lot of people probably didn't notice, but I agreed to pace the Marathon Project mostly because of just kind of what we were saying. Like, I thought it was so cool that they put on this event and they were setting this up for the athletes, and I knew Canadians were running. So I actually talked to my coach and said, hey, like, if they need anyone to help out, this is an event I really support and would love to, you know, contribute any way I could. So I went out there and paced, and it was crazy how successful that event was. And some athletes, you know, just and some of my teammates ran phenomenal. So it was so cool to see a grassroots event put on some of the best times that in North America that have ever been run.
Yeah, and I apologize for not giving you that shout out. We definitely were watching with great attention as you were pacing those groups, and you did a fantastic job. So congrats on that as well. But yeah, I think it's, you know, we talked about this with all of the different huge performances from this year. Mo Ahmed comes to mind, and several others, but just the ability for people to overcome in the face of, you know, one of the most difficult years ever in our sport and in the world has been pretty inspirational. So very cool to be part of that for sure. Well, speaking of your, what might be considered a bit of a relative sprint for you at this point, maybe we should get into this men's 5,000 meter with our dirty stuff. And as always, Maddie, would you like to do the honors of running down the top 10 of this list?
All right, you bet. So I will start at number one, who, one of the more exciting, you know, events of 2020, Joshua Cheptegei of Uganda, his new world record, 12:35.5, no smoke, no fire, clean as a whistle to our knowledge. Number two, Kenan Issa Bekele, Ethiopia, 12:37.3. He ran that in 2004, the then world record, no smoke, no fire. You know him, you love him, second fastest marathoner in history, also great on the track. Number three, Haile Gebrselassie of Ethiopia. He ran a 12:39.3 in 1998. No smoke or fire here also. Little note, this is one of the cleanest events we've done yet, which is wonderful. We love seeing a clean event.
On paper, although we will get into the nitty gritty of why there's maybe a little more under the surface there, but you're right, Maddie, from in terms of like doping infractions, squeaky clean.
Totally.
As in there aren't any.
As in there aren't any. I mean, there's always some nitty gritty, but I at least surface level like the way this looks. All right. Number four, Daniel Komen of Kenya also ran a 12:39.7 in 1997. A little bit of smoke, no fire. Number five is Solomon Barega of Ethiopia. He ran a 12:43 flat in 2018. No smoke, no fire. Number six, Hagos Gebrewet of Ethiopia, 12:45.8. He ran that in 2018, no smoke, no fire. Number seven, Eliud Kipchoge. This is a real who's who list, eh? This is like some of the biggest names who then worked their way up to be probably even bigger names. He ran a 12:46.5 in 2004, and as we all know and love, Kipchoge, no smoke, no fire. Number eight, Yomif Kijelcha, the world record holder in the indoor mile, of Ethiopia ran a 12:46.7 in 2018. And we got some smoke, but no fire. But, you know, there's always a little smoke when it comes to the Nike Oregon project. Number 9, Dejen Gebremeskel of Ethiopia, who ran a 12:46.8 in 2012. No smoke, no fire. And number 10 is Seleshi Sehine of Ethiopia, who ran a 12:47 flat in 2004. No smoke, no fire. And number 11, our Canadian Mohamed. You know, he's not top 10, but because the Canadian's 11th, we're going to give him an honorable mention. And Kate's note here is, who will never do anything bad. And, you know, we don't want to put that kind of pressure on him. People aren't perfect, but, you know, we think there's a promising future for Mo in the world of clean sport.
Well, thanks, Maddie. Like you said, a real who's who of the world of distance running on this list. Quite a range of, you know, dates in terms of like eras of when these times were set. However, not nearly as much as we mentioned, as not quite as wide a range as other events like the Women's 800. So I think we should dive in. But just before we do that, there are two quick notes that I want to mention so that we keep these things in mind as we go through kind of the like detailed nitty gritty of some of these athletes. The first, this is an interesting little tidbit. Another great running podcaster, Mario Fraioli, who, of course, hosts the Morning Shakeout, both as a podcast and a newsletter, wrote a piece back in 2016 about how the 12:50 barrier had only at the time been broken 26 times, and only six of them had been broken since 2010, and they were all from the same race, which was really fascinating. Now, of course, that was 4 years ago. Things have changed. So the 12:50 barrier has now been broken 33 times, but still only 14 of those performances have occurred since 2010. As we mentioned, six of them occurred in the same race in July of 2012 in France, and five of those have occurred this past year in 2020. So this is just interesting because when you're looking at the progress of an event, all the things that we normally talk about, like shoe technology, recovery, like everything that advances a sport would usually indicate that records would get faster and faster. And yet the bulk of these times were set before a lot of these advancements had been made and before there were, you know, modern anti-doping techniques. The other thing to keep in mind is that Ethiopia, which actually boasts seven athletes on this list, was under such huge suspicion for doping that in 2016, the then IAAF, now World Athletics, issued them an ultimatum, which was that they test at least 200 of their top athletes by the end of that year, or they would face a ban by the IAAF and WADA sanctions, very similar to what Russia went through. So although, you know, we're not necessarily saying that any of the athletes on this list should be implicated for that, it's worth mentioning. But with that in mind, let's jump right in and maybe we can start. Maddie, do you want to start with Mr. Cheptegei, our world record holder?
Absolutely. A bright light in a dark year was Joshua Cheptegei's racing in 2020. So he set both the 5,000 and 10,000 meter world records this year, which were both formerly Bekele's and kind of thought of, you know, like the gold, absolute gold standard of distance running. Also, he set the 5K world record, and he's had a super steady trajectory, which is what we look for on this list, is a trajectory that makes sense. He was the 2014 World Junior Champion in the 10,000. So after his World Junior performance, he steadily progressed to double at the Rio Olympics in 2016, where he was a finalist in both the 5,000 meter and then placed sixth in the 10,000 meter. He would go on to steadily improve to become the world champion in 2019 in the 10,000 and the world cross country champion and the 10K road world record holder. So been good for a really long time. One of the best as a junior, and then, you know, made it to the senior level as a senior, fell back a little bit, which makes sense, and then progressed his way back to the top. He's only 24 years old, and this progression, at least on paper, seems legit. And there's, you know, nothing to suggest otherwise.
Ben, what are your thoughts on Mr. Cheptegei, especially watching him crush it over this last year?
Yeah, I mean, Cheptegei was, he was phenomenal this year, and he's been phenomenal for a while, and kind of seemed like in the past couple of years before this year was doing some amazing things that maybe were overshadowed by guys like Mo Farah or some other, I guess, at that time, more notable names. So it kind of just seemed like his time was coming, and this year he kind of showed that it was time. And he looked unstoppable. I know he actually did lose a race, which people were super surprised about, at the World Half Marathon Championships to a fellow Ugandan and someone else in the race as well. But no, I mean, I don't have any experiences racing Cheptegei myself, although I wish I did. He's actually younger than I am. And I mean, he's just run some incredibly, incredibly fast times. But obviously, as you both alluded to, there's been no evidence of anything suspicious. So he just seems like a phenomenal athlete.
Yeah, and he's really fun to watch too. It was really fun watching him both in Monaco and then at the Valencia meet this year, because they were hyped up so much, right? And as Maddie said, a glimmer of light in a dark year, something that really helped to inspire us all, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, the records he broke were Kenny Sabatelli's records, both in the 5 and the 10, that just looked like almost unbreakable records. So I don't know, even with all the hype going around, I was skeptical that someone could actually run that fast in this day and age. And he obviously proved me wrong, and he's a complete metronome. He isn't known to, you know, drop a 55, 56 last lap like Kenny Sabatelli. Instead, he just runs 60 or 61s the whole way through, which is pretty remarkable. And I know they have the lights for the pacing now that people are saying might help an athlete like that, but nonetheless, you still got to be able to run those splits.
Totally. And thank you for bringing that up, Ben, because that's actually something that I made a note, I think, a little further on in this list. But that's kind of the one interesting piece about this, is that although, you know, these more recent times, none of these athletes have failed a drug test. And this is certainly not anything to do with them as individuals. But one of the sort of criticisms has been that while these athletes might not be taking anything banned, they're using sort of like technology doping. So whether it be like the shoe doping conversation or the wave light technology that you were mentioning, Ben, about it being kind of a virtual pacer around a track to let you know what kind of split you're on. There's a lot of debate in the running world, I think, between like the old school purists and the technology advancement proponents, who kind of like go back and forth about whether this stuff should be allowed. But again, certainly that responsibility doesn't fall on the individual athletes by any means. But going from a new shining star to someone who has been arguably the greatest distance runner of all time. In fact, in our most recent issue of Canadian Running Magazine, Paul Gaines wrote a great article all about why he considers Kenenisa Bekele of Ethiopia, number two on this list, the 38-year-old, to be the greatest distance runner ever. And there is some good evidence to back that up. So Bekele's had just a stunning career, going back to 1999 as a youth and then on to a junior world championship medalist and junior world record holder. Since then, he has won 4 Olympic medals, 6 world championship medals, 11 world cross country championships. He has the most number of world cross country championship wins of any athlete in the world. He was a huge success on the track and through the cross-country courses until about 2012, which is when he switched primarily to the roads. And then, of course, since then, he set multiple road world records as well, including the marathon. So he ran this 5,000-meter world record back in 2004. Again, he's never failed a drug test or served any bans. However, again, speaking kind of to the culture in Ethiopia, there is some concern about the rampant doping and easy access to banned substances in that country. And in fact, in 2017, there was a joint investigation by the publication The Guardian, as well as the German broadcaster ARD, that actually led to some of this concern with the IAAF around doping and resulted in Ethiopia implementing jail time for caught dopers. So they've actually criminalized doping in that country in an effort to quell the rampant use of banned substances. So I, you know, as a huge fan of the sport and of people like Bekele and Gabor Selassie going back years, I really want to believe they're clean. There's really nothing on paper to indicate otherwise, but again, good context to keep in mind.
Yeah. I mean, Kenenisa Bekele, as an athlete, I obviously followed a ton as growing up in the sport. I think he was kind of just moving on as I was getting more and more serious. But he's the name at the top of the record board that I saw for so long. And I know what piqued particular interest in terms of him just being on another level, even compared to the people that were closest in history to him was his 10K world record until Cheptegei just most recently ran faster than it. I know that record was, if I'm not mistaken, close to 20 seconds faster than any other athlete has ever run. So I know that there's been people that led to some skepticism that he just was so much better than the next people in line behind him. But, you know, kind of as you said, there's nothing on paper to indicate any sort of suspicious activity, and fast times don't correlate or they don't warrant any or justify any sort of suspicion. But I do remember that 10K just being unusually fast compared to anybody else that's ever run that distance. But now Cheptegei just ran faster than it, so it shows it can be done.
Absolutely. And that's what, I mean, records are made to be broken, right? That's what we like to see. Maddie, do you want to take us to number three?
You got it. Haile Gebrselassie. Another stellar career, both on the track and the roads, going back to the 1992 World Junior Championships, where he won double gold in the 5 and 10,000 meter. He has been very outspoken about increasing anti-doping measures, saying that it's not just about the punishment handed to caught cheaters. It's about changing the cultural attitude towards doping in the continent of Africa. He strongly defended jail time for dopers in Ethiopia, and him and Mo Farah, they fight, pretty critical of one another. And Gebrselassie was highly critical of Farah and his affiliation with high-profile members of the sport involved in doping scandals. Yeah, I don't know how much credence I want to give to the Gebrselassie Farah stuff, because there's been like tit for tat back and forth. It's, you know, it's a little bit like if running had a gossip column, like those two would both be highly featured. But either way, Gebrselassie on paper, clean career.
Yeah. And again, one of the greats, and he has been just so staunchly anti-doping for so long. You know, that doesn't always mean that you're not doing it yourself, but he's so passionate about it. It really leads me to believe, at least in the way that he's talking, that he feels that that this is the wrong thing to do and that he would never have done it himself. Again, just to keep in mind that he has one of the older times on this list, and he was the double Olympic champion actually going back in 1996 and 2000. And we do know that those were big years for doping, particularly around the drug EPO. Again, never failed a test. He's probably one of the, you know, most tested athletes in our sport. So kudos, Gebrselassie. We're hoping that you're clean. Yeah.
I don't know a whole lot of Gebrselassie's career, just because his best years were before I really closely followed the sport. But at least the depiction that I get is that he was almost like a Kipchoge of the world in that time, where he was just a world-renowned runner that just had a ton of respect from everyone. And it's great to see that he's obviously a big advocate for clean sport. But yeah, I think overall, it's he's just run some crazy times. Even Daniel Coleman coming up next is probably, like, you know, with no offense at all, I mean, Daniel Coleman is arguably probably like the least recognizable name on this list, but his PRs are insane. Like, his sub-8-minute 2-mile and his 3K world record of 7:20 are just, like, I mean, hard to believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that, I mean, thank you for introducing that, Ben. So Daniel Coleman, number 4 on this list, 12:39, going back to 1997. You're right. I think part of the reason that he's perhaps less recognized is he had such a relatively short career compared to these other guys. So again, like many of the men on this list, he was a super successful junior. He actually set a world junior record in the 5,000 in 1994. But then really his most competitive years were just kind of in this window between like 95 and 97, I would say, were where he was most successful. So he set that 3,000 meter world record in 96, as you said, Ben, which still stands. He set the 2-mile world record in 97, still the only man to have broken 8 minutes in a 2-mile. And this is really easy math, I know, but I'm going to just state the obvious. That means that he ran under 4 minutes flat per mile twice continually. I honestly had to like triple check that record, I think 3 or 4 times, because it's an off distance, right? So it's not run that often, but it's also, that might be the most impressive result on this list for me, honestly. That's hard to fathom.
Yeah.
Well, especially since in North America, like, the public still has like You mean to say you broke 4 minutes for a mile? Crazy.
But yeah, I mean, Komen, obviously just a huge talent for a fairly short time. He kind of capped his career with a world championship win in 97 in the 5,000 meter the same year that he ran this 12:39. Again, kind of similar to Gabor Selassie in terms of the era he was running within. He was, you know, EPO use was rife during that time. There wasn't even a test for EPO introduced to the Olympics until the year 2000. So we know that, you know, a lot of people went undetected, particularly if they were microdosing. So the interesting thing with Daniel Komen is that he is the only man on this list to actually have failed a drug test, but it was for excessive levels of caffeine. So in 97, his last major competitive year, he tested positive twice for excessive levels of caffeine. And at the time, that could have resulted in a 3-month ban from WADA, but he never served one because he blamed his metabolism for being slow and clearing caffeine slowly from his system, and apparently had enough evidence to prove that to the powers that be. So he never actually served a ban, but it is worth noting that he had two positive tests for basically either chugging too much coffee or taking too many caffeine pills.
And this is half a question and half a statement. As far as I know, caffeine isn't even a banned substance anymore. Like, the only thing I'm thinking is maybe that the level is so high that no one crosses it. But as far as I know, I actually don't even think it's on the banned substance list.
I'm pretty sure it is. I think it is, but the threshold for caffeine is like insane. Like, you would like might as well be on Coke if you had that much caffeine.
Right. Because I know it's still banned in the collegiate system.
Caffeine is like banned in the NCAA.
But in the same context that you described, that the threshold is so high that no one, even college students who are, you know, putting back as much caffeine as possible, no one hits it. But I have a feeling that it was there was like a pitch to reintroduce it to the banned substance list, which is why I don't think it's on there. But Kate, I'm curious if you have a...
Yeah, I just pulled it up. And Ben, you're absolutely right. So there's this nifty little website called the Global DRO, which we've mentioned it before. All athletes should familiarize themselves with this website because it's super handy for looking up substances. But caffeine is not banned in competition or out of competition. However, there is a little asterisk saying that the intravenous infusion and or injection of more than 100 milliliters per 12-hour period is prohibited. So it has to do with the delivery route, I guess. Like, if you consume it orally, apparently there's no restriction whatsoever as to how much you have. Although I would imagine that at a certain point, just being like totally hopped up on 17 espressos couldn't be good for your performance. I don't know. For me, it wouldn't be anyway.
I had one race where I overdid it. Like, it was just, it was the end of, I don't know if it was called U Sports or CIs then, but either way, it was day three. And it was one of the years when I think I synctupled. I don't know. I ran five events and it was insane. And before the morning of day three, I did like a Starbucks grande and washed down a couple caffeine pills because like you were just kind of like smacking your face. Like, what's my name? Where am I? This is like my seventh race of the weekend. And I truly overdid it. Like, I felt nauseous. I couldn't keep my hands still. Too much caffeine is not beneficial to your performance.
No bueno. Yeah, for sure. Maddie, do you want to take us to Seliman Berega, the youngest athlete on this list and like a real shocker in terms of what he's accomplished
so far? He's 20 years old. That's, I knew someone on this list was really young. We found it.
Yeah.
Seliman Berega of Ethiopia, who is number 5, is only 20 years old, as we mentioned, and has had an amazing career thus far. He, in 2016, won the 5,000 meter at the U20 World Championships, despite being only 16, which makes him technically a youth. In 2017, he won the U18 World Championship in the 3,000, and then has gone on to win medals at senior international championships. So he won silver at the 2018 Indoor World Championships in the 3,000 meter, and 2019 silver at the Outdoor World Championships in the 5,000. And in 2019, he would have been 19. So still a junior. Very impressive.
Yeah, and his time of 12:43, his best ever, set in 2018, is still, of course, the world junior record. And I have a hard time believing that's going to go down anytime soon. That is just stunning.
Yeah, I mean, with the names ahead of them, Komen, Haile Gebrselassie, and Kenny Sabikele, who are all either at the end of their career or no longer running, you know, and Baraga being 20 years old, there's definitely a total possibility that he moves up and passes some of those athletes in the coming years. So that'll be interesting to see. That takes us to number six on our list, who is actually the only athlete, as far as my knowledge goes, that I've ever competed against, who is Hagos Gebrewet. And I've actually competed with him twice. So more recently, I competed with him at a BAA Road 5K. It's a 5K championships on the road that happens right before the Boston Marathon, in which he won, and I was fourth. And before that, I can barely call it competing with him, but I was in the same race as him at the World Junior Cross Country Championships, in which he was first again. And I was, I believe I was 29th or something. And, I'm pretty sure he beat me by 2 minutes. So I think there was like an argument that he would have had a shot at contending for the senior title at that time. But anyways, you know, he holds a best of 12:45 in the 5,000 meter. He's just always been in it. Again, kind of one of those guys that I think's been in the shadow of Mo Farah more recently. But he's got a world championship silver medal. He is a world junior indoor record holder in the 3,000. And then a couple bronzes from the world championships in 2015 and the Rio Olympics. Certainly a guy I don't think is going away anytime soon. But I don't know. I think he just had... the timing wasn't perfect for him. He competed against Mo Farah, and then as soon as Mo Farah's gone and out of here, he's competing against these younger guys like Baraga and Cheptegei, who are now kind of taking the attention now. So, but nonetheless, a guy that's always competitive in Diamond League events and surely can run faster than 12:45 in the next couple of years if something gets set up.
Well, and in some ways, it's nice to see that he's got these young bucks to contend with, because we know that the more people running around those, you know, super fast times, the easier it is to be dragged along or at least jump on the train and see what you can do. So more to come from him for sure.
Yeah. And I know I have to be careful what I say, because by no means do I mean he has had unsuccessful career. He's got an Olympic medal already, but it's just a guy that so easily could have been on top of the track world for a moment there, but just had some of the toughest guys at the same time as him. So, but nonetheless, he's still quite young. I think he's actually the same age as me, so not getting younger, but he's got time to improve on those PRs.
For both of you, that's true.
Yes, exactly.
The man who needs no introduction, Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya, who has had a stunning, very long career all the way back to 2002, and is probably the best known runner on planet Earth right now. He has gone to win 3 Olympic medals, 2 world championship medals, 8 world major marathons, set a marathon world record, and of course is the only human being to ever run under 2 hours for the marathon. Whether or not you believe that is a real time or not is up to you. However, he's done it. He has never failed a drug test and is outspoken against doping, and he is very supportive of Kenya's criminalization of doping. And I think you got to believe in something in this world, and I believe in Eliud Kipchoge's career. That's kind of all I have to say about that.
Amen. Moving on to number 8. Yomif Kadelcha, also of Ethiopia, also a young buck. He's only 23 years old. Again, has had a really successful career going back to his world youth days, back to 2013. He's gone on to get the gold at the World Junior Championships 5,000 meter in 2014. In 2016 and 2018, he was the world indoor 3,000 meter champion. In the last World Championships in 2019, get the silver medal in that 5,000 meter. Again, he's never failed a doping test, but anytime, as Maddie mentioned, we have athletes who have been closely affiliated with the Nike Oregon Project and, of course, now disgraced coach Alberto Salazar, it raises some eyebrows. And again, just the asterisk beside all of the stuff that we're talking about is to say that just because you have an affiliation with someone certainly does not, you know, immediately indicate that you're guilty. And there, I'm sure, are plenty of great athletes doing the right things, unfortunately caught up with specific people who have, you know, not done the right things in the past, but we're not implying guilt by association by any means.
Totally.
Maddie, you want to do number 9?
Got it. Dejen Gebremeskel of Ethiopia. Again, no smoke, no fire, and also has progression that makes sense. So he was the 2011 World Championship bronze medalist in the 5,000 meter, the 2012 Olympic silver medalist in the 5,000 meter, and the 2014 World Indoor 3,000 meter bronze medalist. And just like he's had great performances, he's also had some, by his standards, kind of lackluster performances. He was 16th at the 2013 10,000 meter World Championship race, and in Rio, he was 12th in the 5,000 meter. Again, 12th is still a finalist, but you know, when you've been a medalist, 12th is not where you want to find yourself. So, but in a way, these, you know, quote unquote lackluster races are also sort of a boon for him, because part of the thing you look for is if he had gone from like medalist to like can't even make the games, it's those spikes that make you weary, but ebbs and flows, you know, like third to 12th, that makes sense. That's, you know, that's kind of how the body goes sometimes.
Totally.
So again, no smoke, no fire, and looking at his results, a sensible trajectory.
And this brings us to our last man on this list, number 10, Seleshe Sehine, also of Ethiopia, a 12:47 set back in 2004. So again, another super successful career going back to his junior days in 2002. He was competitive from 03 on to 2012, had a lot of success both cross country and on the track. Interestingly, he is married to Tirunesh Dibaba, older sister of Genzebe Dibaba, who herself has, you know, come under a little bit of suspicion with her affiliations. But again, you know, no failures there. And certainly, as we mentioned, no guilt by association. Only one thing to mention is that, as we know, also 2004 was sort of tailing off that end of a higher, I would say, use of EPO. But this athlete has never failed a test. And as far as we know, he is clean. Pretty clean list overall, guys.
I like this list. I like this list a lot. I think it is one of the simplest lists we've had.
Absolutely it is. And Ben, you know, our biggest hope is that one day we'll see your name gracing this top 10 list as well, which we just, you know, we can't wait for.
100%. That would be definitely have some work to do until then. But, you know, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, Mo Ahmed is certainly leading the Canadian charge and showing people it's possible to, you know, for Canadians to, you'd be knocking on the door of top 10 performances. So hopefully, whether it's me or younger Canadians that are in the sport right now, hopefully some more athletes can break that 13-minute barrier and crack their way onto the top 10 list as well.
Well, Mo's the first North American, you know, so that's some uncharted waters already.
For sure.
Totally. So Ben, do you have any sort of final thoughts on the state of global doping? Not that that's, you know, that's a pretty small question, I understand. But if you have any sort of final thoughts on the state of global doping and where we're at now in Canada and internationally and maybe what you're hoping for moving forward.
Yeah. Oh, I have a lot of opinions. Probably worth another podcast.
Sure. We'll have you back on to discuss that in full.
Yeah, I would argue every athlete that's ever competed in the sport would probably say it's always been an interesting time for doping in sport and anti-doping advocacy in sport. I think right now, the athletes in the sport right now, what they're noticing is a huge surge in provisional suspensions from whereabouts failures is kind of the hot topic right now. By the AIU is the one issuing those whereabout failures. Kind of something that we talked about a little bit where context is so important in terms of either a country not having super strict anti-doping policies or criminalizing doping. I think the AIU is it seems like there's been more athletes from countries with, you know, not super strict anti-doping policies that are being popped for whereabouts failures. And I have a couple opinions on that. I think, you know, it almost feels like it's worth celebrating when someone gets popped because it's someone that, you know, is cheating and is getting caught for it. But the difficulty with the whereabouts failures is, you know, they didn't actually test positive. And although I think it's incredibly important and for athletes to be responsible and, you know, be able to actually make their tests to make sure they're clean. I hope that the whereabouts failures aren't penalizing athletes that don't have a structured system that hopefully is put in place by their governing bodies. So that's my only concern with that is, you know, I know and with my experience as a Canadian athlete, I have to, you know, I have to do an educational platform every year to confirm that I understand how anti-doping works. I don't know if all countries have resources like that. I am very comfortable in understanding that I need to make tests, how they happen. But again, I'm not sure all countries have that structure. So although I think it's pretty encouraging to see that people are testing positive and that there is some level of accountability in the sport, I'm also a little bit concerned if there's any chance of some athletes being penalized that actually haven't doped, and whether it's based off of irresponsibility, which is more the case of Christian Coleman, which, you know, is a lot less, you know, I'm a lot less, I feel a lot less empathetic towards, because I'm sure he has a lot of structure in place, versus some other athletes that maybe just don't have the structure. I hope that that isn't a problem, but that's kind of the hot topic in my mind right now. Do you have any thoughts on that, Kate?
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing all of that context up, because I think, again, it's important for our listeners to understand that like doping is a complex part of our sport, but so is anti-doping and the enforcement side of that. And we've talked a lot on this show about the whereabouts failures as of late. That's kind of been like the main doping news that we've covered. And again, just for context for our listeners, Ben alluded to the AIU, which is the Athlete Integrity Unit, who is partially responsible for sort of investigating these things. But I think, you know, one of the things that we are really careful to keep in mind is the privilege that we have in Canada and in North America and you know, perhaps in parts of Europe and things like that, where, as you mentioned, like we have a really robust anti-doping system built into our sporting landscape. It's reinforced through our culture. It is, you know, as you said, like there's education that we that's mandatory for us to go through to understand this, to make sure that we have all the resources that we need to make the right decisions. And absolutely, it's true that not every country has that. And in fact, there's many parts of the world where either you don't have access to that, or you are subject to the forces that be above you sort of dictating what you're going to take or not take and how your career will progress. So I really, really appreciate you bringing that aspect up, Ben, because I think it is worth mentioning the privilege that we have to even be able to navigate the system the way that we do.
Yeah. And I you know, at the end of the day, systematically, hopefully the period that we're in right now encourages governing bodies to really, you know, take a step back and focus on that structure and make sure they get to a point where every athlete has the structure in place to make all of their tests. And that if they don't make their tests, that's a very, I feel a lot more comfortable in that mechanism in terms of finding people that are cheating. But I just hope there's no athletes that, you know, take the fall when they shouldn't have. So, and that's not for me to decide. And I don't know enough about the details of the athletes that have had those whereabout failures and those have not. But that's the one thing that I feel, I don't know. It's just when an athlete tests positive, it's so hard to, like, you know, refute that evidence. It's like they had something in their system that they shouldn't have. But yeah, it's a complicated topic nonetheless. So we'll see where it goes. But as we said, for North American athletes to be missing tests, in my opinion, I feel like that's pretty unacceptable. I feel like we have the support there from our governing bodies to make sure we know and are aware. But in other countries, I don't know enough about whether that's there. That's kind of my initial take on everything right now. And, you know, everyone stay clean. It's not worth it.
Totally. Well, and again, you know, just maybe my final note would be going back to Gebre Selassie, you know, saying that he's less concerned about the punishment for individual athletes, although that is important often, but more about like changing the culture or the system, right? Like attack is sort of battling this from a systemic perspective instead of a case-by-case athlete perspective, so that you're, you know, doing things like making sure that anyone who's lining their pockets at the expense of, you know, potentially exposing athletes to risk is, you know, stopped essentially, so that there isn't anything like state sponsored or like big group sponsored doping going on moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Maddie, any final thoughts on this particular topic or event category?
Well, you guys covered it well. And also, we have an attitude towards doping here that is, it is bad, you don't do it. But that's not the case everywhere else. So context with doping is important. It doesn't make it good or fair, but it is still, you know, like in anything, context is key.
Yeah. And, you know, to make things more complicated, the challenging thing is if there's countries that don't have structured anti-doping policies in place and athletes are doping, and that then affects the other athletes that are held very accountable. So it gets really challenging, right? Because it's so hard to, I don't know, just focus on the systematic approach or just the individual approach, especially when you're an athlete, where the individual approach is so important because you're lining up against other individuals, not necessarily knowing the background of their story. So it's complicated. I hope, there's technological advancements that make detection more and more accurate, and the confidence in anti-doping systems can just grow. But it's certainly a work in progress, and you just do the best you can with it.
Well said, Ben. We really appreciate you coming on this segment. We appreciate you coming on the show anytime. We're sorry we haven't had you on. I think it's been about 2 years since we last had you and Justin Knight on. Back, I think one of my very first episodes I did with the Shakeout podcast when I was still kind of figuring out all the kinks. But, we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. And we're so thrilled for the success you've had over this last year. And we're pumped to see what happens for you moving forward. You've got a big fan base with Canadian running.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was a wonderful time being on here with Justin a couple years ago, and it was a wonderful time now. So thanks so much for having me, hope to be back again.
We definitely won't let 2 more years lapse before we get you back on the show, Ben. Thanks again.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Dirty Stuff. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Shakeout Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes. Happy running, and we'll chat again soon.